One of my favorite verses in the Bible comes from John's Gospel, though not from our reading this morning. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Or as some translations put it, and have it to the full. That's John chapter 10, verse 10. Shared within a broader description of Jesus as the Good Shepherd, for me, it is a simple reminder of Jesus's essential ministry, what I consider and perceive and understand as Jesus's essential ministry, and so also ours as those who purport to follow in his footsteps, striving toward abundant life, life to the full and for all. Apart from the resurrection itself, right, the Easter story, there is only one miracle recorded in all four Gospels. And it's safe to say that if every Gospel writer considered it significant enough to include, it must be really, really important. Recalling and echoing Elisha's miraculous feeding from our first reading, the so-called feeding of the 5,000, as Terry also read for us, is that miracle. And make no mistake, it is a miracle about abundance. John's account, like so much of the gospel as a whole, is notably different from the earlier synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I said it before and I say it again, which one of these is not like the others, right? That's John's gospel, if you read through it, very different than the others. In John, large crowds are following Jesus because they've already seen signs that he may be the one they've been waiting for, the prophet, the messianic king that many Jews believed was coming. And within the historical context of first century Palestine, specifically coming to free them from the oppression of Roman occupation. The signs they've seen, according to John, are miracles of healing, Jesus healing the sick, including on the Sabbath. In the other gospel accounts, it is Jesus' disciples who initiate the operative response to the large crowds that are gathering around them. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, after Jesus engages the people as teacher, healer, or both, his disciples say more or less the same thing in the synoptic gospels. This is a deserted place, and the hour is now late. Send the crowd away so that they may go into the villages and buy food for themselves. Apparently, they've had it with the crowds. They're done for the day. But in John's account, it's Jesus who initiates the response in question. He says to Philip, one of the 12, where are we to buy bread for these people to eat? Now understand here that nobody has said anything about feeding the crowd or needing to feed the crowd. So Jesus is very much planting a seed. And yes, this is a setup. We're told that Jesus already knew what he was going to do. John makes sure we get that point. And so we're also told that Jesus, teacher that he is testing his disciples with this prompting question. Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat? And so there is a right answer, and Philip gets it wrong. 6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. We can't do it. We can't possibly buy enough bread for these people to eat. End of discussion. You might say that Philip is operating within a paradigm of scarcity, conceding to the harsh and unjust social and political reality of the day that left so many poor and hungry. There's simply not enough to go around. And so, as the other gospel accounts have it, there's nothing they can do but send the people back to the surrounding villages and fend for themselves. But this, thankfully, is a group discussion. We learn more, we learn better in groups. Amen. Philip is just the first to respond to Jesus' question. So it's Andrew's initial response actually gets us closer to the lesson to be learned here, closer to the heart of the matter. He says, there is a boy here who has five barley loaves and two fish. It is a meager, but what turns out to be mighty, insight. And though on the surface this may be a bit of an overreach on my part, it strikes me that Andrew is demonstrating one of the core principles of grassroots community organizing and development, straight out of Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, that solutions for community problems, that social change emerges most powerfully and sustainably from within communities themselves. In practice, that can take the form of what's become known as asset mapping, communities identifying and accessing their own existing strengths, resources, and capacity to address a problem or injustice, and then grounding the solution in their own leadership and power, not outside it, to ultimately confront the root causes or the problem or injustice. As John McKnight, who's one of the founders of asset-based community development, suggests, how can you possibly know what you need until you figure out what you have? And so Andrew helps identify what the people have, but even he doesn't believe it can begin to touch the need. You can picture him kind of tentatively raising his hand following Philip's response, sharing his observation, but then immediately second-guessing himself. There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they among so many people? What are they among so many people? Think about it. In the midst of a crowd of thousands, right? The text says 5,000, but that's 5,000 men. So we're talking probably 10,000 or more people, men, women, children. Who cares about 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish? What difference is that going to make? Well, Jesus does care, for one. And again, consummate teacher that he is, Jesus answers Andrew's question by showing rather than telling. Make the people sit down, he says, and let me show you what 5 loaves and 2 fish are among so many people. Let me show you how something so small, so seemingly insignificant, can make all the difference in the world. Think of the loaves and the fish as a mustard seed. This is a paradigm of community empowerment, a paradigm not based on scarcity, but abundance. And the rest of the story is familiar because all 4 Gospels provide the same basic details. It's the story you've heard 100 times before if you spent any part of your life in the church or in Sunday school. When everyone is seated, Jesus takes the loaves and the fish. He gives thanks. And here in the original Greek is the word for thanksgiving, from which we get Eucharist. And then he spreads the unexpected, surprising wealth, as much as they wanted, we're told, until they were satisfied, we're told. And with that, the narrative takes us, and Jesus takes us, on a journey from scarcity to satisfaction and sufficiency, from not enough, not even close to enough, to enough. But that, I don't think, is the heart of the story yet. Enough would be a pretty good ending under the circumstances, but there's much more to the story. Jesus has the disciples gather up the fragments, and they end up with 12 baskets. 12 baskets, all 4 Gospels confirm that same amount. 12 baskets of breadcrumbs and broken pieces of fish. The deeper lesson here, the lesson Jesus is getting at with his test, is found in those baskets, in the fragments, the leftovers, the broken pieces. We don't know how big the baskets are, but it doesn't matter. Beyond the miraculous feeding itself, we are meant to register how extraordinary it is that among a crowd of thousands, again, probably tens of thousands, there are 12 baskets left over from what began with 1 little boy, 5 loaves and 2 fish. The miracle extends further. The narrative journey has already moved us from a paradigm of not enough to enough. And so now from enough to more than enough. More than enough, abundance. And to appreciate that piece of the story, we have to appreciate the fact that Jesus bothers to collect the leftovers in the first place. I mean, everyone's been fed and satisfied. He's already accomplished what he wanted, right? Why bother? Through the lens of our consumerist capitalist culture, where abundance is disposable, where inequality is portrayed as the inevitable consequence of individual failures and deficits, where the myth of scarcity serves to fuel our personal, social, economic, and political insecurities and fears. Consider just how radical it is that Jesus minds the leftovers. That, for me, is the lesson. That is the heart of the story. Abundance of body, and for that matter, abundance of mind and spirit, and therefore life as a whole, requires that nothing be wasted, that no thing and no one be wasted or thrown away. As Anglican priest Rachel Mann writes, Jesus invites us to gather up the fragments, for it's part of the nature of broken bread that fragments will fall. Yet at heart of Jesus's economy is the desire that nothing that matters, that might actually feed us, should be lost. It is only possible to gather up the fragments, that is, the leftovers, if we are ever satisfied. I'm not even sure we know anymore what truly feeds us. Our culture is thrilled with its capacity to consume and generate vast wealth for the few while pushing increasing numbers toward the food bank. Fragments and humanity, she writes, and love are seemingly being lost. For Jan Richardson, who I know many of you know, the gathered fragments are a sign of the sometimes hidden wholeness and abundance that Jesus came to reveal. She offers her blessing the fragments. It goes like this. Cup your hands together and you will see the shape this blessing wants to take. Basket, bowl, vessel, it cannot help but hold itself open to welcome what comes. This blessing knows the secret of the fragments that find their way into its keeping, the wholeness that may hide in what has been left behind, the persistence of plenty where there seemed only lack. Look into the hollows of your hands and ask what wants to be gathered there, what abundance waits among the scraps that come to you, what feast will offer itself from the fragments that remain. It shouldn't surprise us that the people who enjoy this miraculous feast took it as another sign, a sure sign, in fact, because it was enough to confirm for some of them that Jesus was indeed the one they'd been waiting for. John's text goes on to tell us that they were about to take him by force and make him king. That's how strongly they felt. But Jesus wanted no part of that. He was not looking to be the kind of king they had in mind. In fact, I see Jesus in this all too familiar story trying instead to point the spotlight back on the people, imploring them, including but not limited to the disciples, to consider that they are the ones, together in shared community, they've been waiting for to make abundance possible. The world God created and is constantly, miraculously recreating with us already has more than enough to go around, more than enough bread, literally and metaphorically, to go around. But that is a truth realized only if and when we, in our individual and collective power, open our eyes and our hearts to embrace the divine promise of abundance, what Jan Richardson calls the persistence of plenty, as we just read. Only if and when we stop conceding to voices inside and outside ourselves and structures that dictate otherwise. Only if and when we stop looking outside ourselves and our communities for the personal and social change we seek. And when we reject and confront the myth of scarcity so forcefully promoted by the prevailing social, economic, and political powers that be. What difference would it make in your life, in the lives of those around you, in the world, if your starting point was abundance rather than scarcity? And what difference does it make when your starting point is abundance rather than scarcity? Friends, we are the ones we've been waiting for. Knowing what we have already helps us clarify what we need in our pursuit of abundant life. Jesus reminds us as much in this story, and that a world of abundance where there is always, always more than enough, where nothing is wasted, is closer than we think. May it be so.